Here it's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Voters in Wisconsin are casting their ballots on this partisan primary election day. Polls are open until 8 this evening.
In the lead up to the primary, WPR compiled a voter guide with candidate responses on a variety of issues. You can find that guide at WPR.org/elections.
And tomorrow on the show, our politics team will provide a full recap of primary election results and analysis as we head into the fall midterms.
Now, turning to our state's workforce. More college-educated workers move out of Wisconsin each year than move in, leading to what economists call brain drain.
A new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum finds that Wisconsin has the second biggest net loss of young educated workers in the country, just behind North Dakota.
In a bit, we'll hear from an economist about how this affects rural communities around the state.
But first, Joe Pietrangelo is research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He's one of the authors of this report called Brain Drain Erodes State's Talent Potential. Joe, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Give us a working knowledge of brain drain and how you measure this for Wisconsin in this report.
Yeah, so in this report, we compare the share of adults with bachelor's degrees or advanced degrees who were born in Wisconsin and now live in another state, who we refer to as leavers, with the share with bachelor's degrees who were born in other states and now live in Wisconsin, who we call entrants. And so we compare those rates of college attainment. And that's where we find this big gap between those who leave Wisconsin and those who enter Wisconsin, which, as you said, is the second largest in the country.
So looking closer at these leavers, if these young, educated people aren't interested in making a life in their native Wisconsin, where are they going?
Well, they're going to a number of states. Minnesota is the state where we saw the biggest, the highest percentage of college-educated Wisconsinites moving to. Is about 17 or 18% of the total. But they're also moving to western and southern states like California, Colorado, Texas. So some fast-growing states, some warmer states, you know, and some of that, you know, it's hard to compete with in some ways, but you know, there are other ways that Wisconsin can be competitive, and we're doing pretty well within the Midwest, with the exception of Minnesota.
And your report, it cites that these Wisconsin-born adults who've moved to other states, they're more likely to be college-educated than their counterparts, the people who have settled here from another state. What can you tell us about that education level trade-off?
Yeah, so about 60% of Wisconsin-born adults who are in their 30s, we really focused on adults in their 30s, mm-hmm. because they are, you know, they've completed college, they're so early in their careers. And so about 60% of those born in Wisconsin, now in their 30s and live in another state, have a bachelor's degree or higher, and only about 45% of those who were born in other states, moved into Wisconsin, are in their 30s, have that college degree. So it's a pretty big gap. Is that did I answer your question?
Yes, it is. It seems as if the educated young adults, they're more of those are moving out, and yet we're not receiving that same influx of education level here. How does this loss of college educated workers affect the economy here in Wisconsin? What are the ripple effects?
Well, so our previous research found that a majority of job openings in Wisconsin that pay at least $50,000 per year and were expected to open up by 2030 are in occupations that typically require bachelor's or advanced degrees. So that is so it's really important to have the workers to fill those roles as they come available. And, you know, we also found that job growth during the 2010s was primarily in those occupations that tend to require bachelor's and advanced degrees. So that's kind of the direction the economy has been heading. And also that during the pandemic, those jobs that are higher paying tend to require degrees were more durable, meaning they were far less likely to have been lost during the pandemic relative to lower paying jobs that were less likely to require a degree.
So other states are also grappling with brain drain. What are some steps that other states have taken that policymakers here in Wisconsin could consider?
Well, we did look at a couple of examples. For example, in Ohio, they have been discounting mortgage rates for recent college graduates to try to, retain them in that state. Minnesota has a network of organizations that work to recruit people to move to rural areas of Minnesota, which has shown some promise. Some states use tax-based incentives for recent college graduates to try to retain them. So those are just some of the examples we found from other states.
Do you anticipate this trend could continue? You've documented this brain drain for quite some time.
Right. We did the same analysis looking at data from 2009. So that would have been people in their 30s back in 2009. And at that time, when we looked at the difference, again, we found Wisconsin had the biggest gap in college attainment between those leavers and entrants. So this is a longstanding challenge. I want to point out, though, that some of the there are some advantages Wisconsin has that have weakened the impact of this brain drain, and so that's positive and are things that we should try to continue, which is that we outperform the nation on college completion in general. So among people born in Wisconsin, they're more likely to earn a college degree, whether they stay in Wisconsin or move to another state, than the national average. So that helps because we start in a stronger position. And so even though we're losing some of those adults, we end up looking pretty average on educational attainment.
Joe, thank you for the research. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you again.
We've been talking with Joe Pietrangelo, Research Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, co-author of this new report finding that Wisconsin has among the worst brain drain in the country. Now for a look at how the departure of highly educated people from our state affects local economies, we're joined by Tessa Conroy. She's an associate professor of agriculture and applied economics at UW-Madison and an economic development specialist with UW Extension. Tessa, thanks for being here.
Of course. Good morning. It's good to be here.
Brain drain often discussed in terms of cities, large metro areas losing out on skilled workers. How does this affect rural communities?
Yeah, I think rural communities have been worried about this for a long time. It can be a hard pill to swallow for rural communities and rural families to see some of their talented young people leave and never come back. Especially at a moment when rural communities are hurting for healthcare professionals, veterinarians, lawyers, teachers, and filling local leadership positions. And even when it comes to school enrollment, thinking about how do we get enough kids here to keep our schools open. So this loss is really felt in the experience of living in these communities. It can be harder to access some of those services to keep some of those anchor institutions in place.
So the pandemic era really changed everything with work from home. How does remote work fit into the issue of brain drain?
Yeah, I think that that has changed the way people think about living in rural areas. I think it's a lot more tractable to live in a rural area, but have your employer be somewhere else. Workers are a little less anchored than they used to be. And I think that's exciting for rural communities. I think the potential exists for young people to leave to get the training and some of the experiences that aren't available locally, but then want to come home to their community. And I think the focus for a lot of rural communities is just creating that place that we call them boomerang migrants, that those young people that leave that they want to come back to, that they are desirable, that they have all of those amenities and that quality of life that young workers are seeking.
Talk more about that quality of life, because when these boomerangs come back to their roots, they've come back with more education. They've seen other different parts of the country or perhaps the world. They've seen different systems of living. How can that impact their local community?
I think it's really impactful. They're bringing back with them the ability to provide essential services. I mentioned healthcare professionals, I mentioned teachers, lawyers, veterinarians. Those are all really important for rural communities. Pharmacists is something that we've been talking about more and more. So coming back with the ability to provide some of those services and then inform leadership too. A lot of our rural communities rely on volunteers in different capacities. And so bringing a unique perspective, coming in with some ideas can be really beneficial for rural communities.
There seems to be this notion that if you create the jobs, the people will come. But Tessa, there's a lot of rural communities in the state that are really struggling to fill open positions. What is the disconnect that's happening there?
Absolutely. I think we're facing a long-run sort of structural labor shortage. And so more and more we're hearing communities say, we have more jobs than people to fill them right now. We need to attract residents. And that really changes the game. And a lot of communities, because of that, are thinking about, well, how do we attract and retain families and young people? And the focus becomes quality of life. We want to emphasize the fact that you can live here and know your neighbors. You can be closer to nature, get away from congestion. And they're starting to address those key aspects of life that make it possible to live easily in a place. And that can include childcare availability, for example. We're seeing communities come together and address childcare. Our school districts and our hospitals are getting involved in making childcare more available. We're seeing investments in parks and events that bring people together. So thinking more holistically about all of the things that make your community a nice place to live has really become front and center in rural development.
As we close here very quickly, our state's challenges with brain drain, they've been longstanding, well-documented, as stated in this policy forum report. Why can't we solve this?
I think part of it's to be expected that whether we're going from rural to urban or from Wisconsin to other states, part of it is just about workers moving to those large employment centers. Mm-hmm. Cities just offer more jobs and a more variety of jobs. So I expect that will continue to be attractive. When we look at the big cities in Wisconsin, they're just not in the same weight class as some of the big cities in our neighbors. And so I expect those will continue to be attractive, but that doesn't necessarily mean that Wisconsin is failing or not doing well. When we look at those quality of life metrics that I mentioned before, when we look at livability, Wisconsin really has a lot to offer.
Tessa, thank you so much for joining us. Tessa Conroy, Associate Professor of Agriculture and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. Earlier, we heard from Joe Pietrangelo, Research Director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum.
Coming up, pregnant women serving sentences. A prison doula project in Wisconsin is trying to make sure women have support as they go through an emotionally difficult childbirth.
Giving birth by themselves and giving birth with some form of correctional staff in the room with them.
Inside the Wisconsin Prison Birth Project, that's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last year, the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin successfully sued the state Department of Corrections for not having a program for incarcerated mothers and their infants.
Under a 1991 Wisconsin law, it's been a requirement for the department to have one. The state offers programs for mothers on probation and parole, but not for those who are incarcerated.
The corrections department says it lacks the funding to create a program, but earlier this year, a judge ordered the department to implement one without delay.
Doulas are trying to fill the gaps. Doulas are trained professionals who become an advocate for women during pregnancy, birth, and postpartum.
For the last year, the OSTARA initiative has offered support for pregnant and postpartum women at Wisconsin's jails and prisons. It's called the Wisconsin Prison Birth Project.
Women in the program recently wrote letters about their experience going through pregnancy while incarcerated. Three doulas who work with them, Jasmine, Shanita, and Tracy, read from the letters.
Some of us will not see our babies because of distance or limited resources. Incarceration harms our children. We don't want them to pay for our mistakes.
I constantly feel horrible, and I live in emotional pain filled with worry. I worry that without my love, my baby could die of a broken heart.
My own childhood left me with a broken heart. It feels impossible to heal and grow in prison.
Incarceration for mothers is different than fathers. A part of me has been ripped out of me. My son has now experienced trauma from birth.
What led me to coming here is just getting worse. I feel less than human. I want and need support to be the mother my baby deserves.
There is nothing I want but to hold my children, to be able to love them. My love for my child is a good, alive part of me, but this process and this system feels like they are trying to kill me.
Now, the OSTARA Initiative has a proposal for a state program to unite incarcerated mothers and their young children.
Erica Garrity is founder and executive director of the OSTARA Initiative. It's a doula-led organization working in correctional systems in 5 states, including here in Wisconsin. Erica, welcome.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.
We just heard the words of some of these women incarcerated, and there are so many facets to a pregnancy. What are some common experiences and challenges that these women face?
Well, for one, I think the majority of the pregnancies are unplanned. So as we're meeting with our clients, participants for the first time, they're reconciling with the idea that they're going to be bringing life into the world in this situation that no one really ever imagined. And that is a lot to get their head around. None of us probably would want this for our child. So that's one of the biggest barriers. And then the very next thing I have heard people say is them needing to accept that they will be doing that without loved ones for the majority of their pregnancy, and giving birth by themselves and giving birth with some form of correctional staff in the room with them, which is pretty unnatural. I don't think any of us who have given birth would choose that for ourselves. So that's a lot for people to try to understand. And then the next part is currently most people in America who are giving birth will have just 24 hours with their newborn, and then they will face being separated from that infant. And really, from my experience in the last 20 plus years, I think this is one of the most painful things that a person giving birth could experience, is bonding with your child, loving your child, going through the whole process of giving birth, meeting your child for the first time, and then having to say goodbye to your child just within 1, sometimes 2 days.
You have been able to, at times, be in the room for these labor and delivery moments. What is that like? What might a woman want in those circumstances?
Yeah, I think it's pretty universal. It's first and foremost to feel safe. Giving birth is a very physiological, biological process, and it can bring up a lot of vulnerability for all of us, can elicit a lot of joy, a lot of trauma, and needing to feel safe is so foundational to having a safe, healthy birth experience. And that's complicated when you're not in your home environment or with your loved ones, but you're with strangers. So as prison doulas, we have a really unique role to fill this special place in someone's life, where we are providing emotional support, physical support in the place of their loved ones. It's a really big role to fill. The reason this job even came to be is because a long, long time ago, I was working in a prison, and some of the other women in the prison acknowledged that this was just really scary to go through. And they asked if I would explore creating some kind of a program to support the women going through that, so they wouldn't have to go through that by themselves. So that's when I discovered doula work a long time ago.
If you are with the woman giving birth and the family can't be there, you're witnessing this moment that is so unique and so special and so filled with emotion.
Mm-hmm.
How do you mark that moment? How do you make sure that, that it happened in some respects?
Mm-hmm. Well, doulas do this very special thing, which is carry the memory of the birth with the mother. So you know, we're talking about it, processing it, you know, holding her hand, helping her make informed decisions during her labor if she has questions, helping her when she's struggling. We are able to take photos for her, you know, in most of the facilities we work in, so that she can have a memory of what that birth experience was. A lot of people today in America who don't have access to prison doula projects actually don't get pictures of them with their infants. And I've heard some women say it feels like that didn't even happen. Like, there's no evidence, and it's so traumatizing that their brain almost tries to forget it. So we're able to take photos. We're able to really be a resource in the room that reminds everyone that in spite of the circumstances, you know, a life is being born here today and it deserves to be celebrated and honored.
Postpartum time is such a sensitive time for women. What is it like for these women that you work with?
Yeah, these, I think as prison doulas, we would say, you know, the times of separation where infants are removed from their mothers are kind of the worst days of everyone's life. It's very, very grueling work, but it also is, it's just the best work to show up so someone doesn't have to go through that alone, and to remind people that they can emotionally survive that and there's something on the other side of that. So it's a very hard time for people. It's a very, very hard time for people. And we try to remind people to do really simple things like come out of their cell, please get fresh air, please try to eat, please try to take a shower, have someone you trust that you check in with every day, please come to group. The doulas meet with our clients regularly, and we do screenings for postpartum depression. And we do a lot of educational components in our group about how to prevent adverse perinatal mental health outcomes. So things like journaling, coloring, storytelling, and visiting with your babies, even virtually. They have tablets where they can talk to the children over video. Having people record your voice for your infant to know your voice, so that people feel like they're still offering something to their babies and that their babies are still remembering them. That's something that's particularly emotionally painful for people, the idea that their baby will forget them and not know them.
In these roughly 2 hours a week you're spending with these women, what are some ways you're connecting and forming this trust? What are those activities like?
We're going 2 hours a week for the duration of your pregnancy. So we have time to talk very deeply into things like fetal brain development, right? Mm-hmm. So we actually can have pretty deep conversations around what's happening with your baby this week. How do you bond with your baby in utero? What are really healthy food decisions you can make in your pregnancy, even from prison? What are good choices you can make from canteen if you're ordering off of canteen? Because, you know, in prison you have limited food options, but people, even you can use, you know, from a harm reduction perspective, you can make healthier options off of canteen, right? And that is a gift to offer your baby, is to make better food choices. Are you drinking enough water? You know, what are warning signs in pregnancy? A lot of the moms we work with have a history of adverse pregnancy outcomes. So a lot of moms haven't carried babies to term in the past for, you know, all kinds of reasons, but a lot having to do with stress, a lot having to do with poverty. And we're helping people understand, like, how do you stay healthy in your pregnancy? Why is it important to try to get your baby to at least 38 weeks of pregnancy? And we find that people are very interested in that information and very interested in making healthy choices when presented with information.
The State Department of Corrections has not implemented a program to help pregnant and new mothers in prison to have custody of their child for the first year of their lives. But OSTARA has come up with a plan for what a program like this could look like in the state prison system. Can you describe what that vision might look like?
Ostara has been looking for a site to pilot what we would like to see as kind of a best-in-the-country model that would serve as an alternative to incarceration for mothers and infants so that people aren't going to even be delivering in custody, but instead are being offered really holistic wraparound services that can help people make good choices in pregnancy, but also can help women get the skills and resources they need to learn about early parenting and healthy attachment with their infants. So, you know, babies only get one beginning to life. Mm-hmm. It's this very, like, ripe, powerful moment in terms of investment in human life. And we believe that if we can create an environment where we can do the absolute most with that, we can prevent really expensive long-term risk and adversity. So our hope is that we could create a community residential living environment where potentially people from jails, community corrections, and even potentially the state prison could be sentenced to as an alternative to incarceration. They could come at any time of their pregnancy and they could stay until their baby's first birthday. And there they would get comprehensive perinatal mental health support, nutritious meals, really quality trauma-informed treatments, and doula care, of course. And the hope would be that we could prevent some of the adversity that we're seeing right now with children's mental health.
The State Department of Corrections has said that they don't have the state funding available to implement a program, you know, in women's prisons. How do you think a program like the one you described would work with the current funding and the current capacity constraints?
Yeah, I'm very curious about how we can build programs with existing resources. So this issue touches on lots and lots of different aspects of our social safety net. And is there a way we could use things like existing infrastructure? We could leverage existing like policies, mechanisms, statutes, funding mechanisms, and bring those things together to try to create something that could work to solve this solution. So, you know, nonprofits have access to funding in the philanthropic landscape. and I think as a nonprofit, we can partner with government entities and different government entities, right? Like some of our biggest funder right now is through the Department of Health in a maternal health innovation grant. So we can draw funding like that, that the Department of Corrections can't necessarily draw from. So we could take some of that money. We can take some federal funding and bring that to us. And hopefully we could partner potentially with counties or departments of corrections to also patch together in a very creative way long-term funding solutions that would be sustainable and don't have to entirely come from a corrections budget, because this isn't a corrections issue, right? Mm-hmm. This is an infant health issue. This is a child development issue. This is a community safety issue. It's many, many, many things.
Last year, 14 mothers gave birth while serving sentences in Wisconsin. And when you look compared to the general prison population, that's a small mm-hmm. number. Mm-hmm. Why is it so important to focus resources with these 14?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it's two generations at one time. So that's very powerful to focus some resources on that. And instead of thinking about so much resources on so little, I think about the impact of what focusing resources on that small group could truly be, which is very, very significant. I think, you know, we're talking about newborn babies in this situation who absolutely do not have a voice but are so profoundly impacted by some of our systems that are not functioning well right now. And for people who are listening to this story, I think we can easily get frustrated and overwhelmed by what we feel is not working. But there really are vulnerable people that are the generation after us who need us to pay attention and be inspired and have hope that some of these things can be fixed. and that we can do better. And I just, I don't want people to get lost in apathy that there aren't potential solutions, because I see every day, even just something simple as the Prison Doula Project, it is not expensive. We get great outcomes and we see positive change from something like that. So in a time where things can feel overwhelming and kind of sad, like, there is always good to be created, and children need that from us. They're being born every day.
What are your next steps toward implementing a program? Where is Ostara at right now?
Yeah, so right now we really have built out a lot of the internal policies of what the programming could look like. We're in relationship with a lot of different providers around the state, and we have started a large-scale major gifts campaign in the state of Wisconsin to raise $4.5 million to acquire a property somewhere within about 30 miles of Madison, where we hope to build the property.
Erica, thank you so much for joining
us. Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
That is Erica Garrity, founder and executive director of the Ostara Initiative. It's a doula-led organization that supports pregnant and postpartum women in correctional systems in 5 states, including Wisconsin. When reached for comment, the Department of Corrections said the state legislature declined to fund such a program and refused to expand the system's earned release program. Here is a part of that statement. Quote, "The practical effect of this is that DOC is required to expand the program to include incarcerated mothers with no additional funding, with no statutory changes that would allow more incarcerated women to take part," end quote. They declined our request for an interview due to ongoing litigation.
Coming up, a hunger relief project brings fresh produce from small and mid-sized Wisconsin farms to families in need. An organic egg farmer in Oconomowoc tells us why he joined the program.
In terms of business, it helps us grow, but it also allows us to live out our true values, which is equally important to our family and all of our employees.
That's next here on WPR News.
Join us today starting at 11 when we get the latest on how UW Health is leading the fight against ovarian cancer. We'll also invite you to be a part of the new Living Donor Initiative that is already saving lives. The Lee Rayburn Show from 11 to 1.
We cover lots of angles of artificial intelligence on 1A. The data centers powering it, the companies creating it, how it should or can be regulated. But how will AI change your daily life? We bring you an exclusive conversation from 1A at the Aspen Ideas Festival, all about your life optimized. That's next time on 1A.
Coming up next on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from Door County Auditorium in Fish Creek. With upcoming shows this month, including G-Love and Special Sauce, I'm With Her, and Happy Together. More at dcauditorium.org.
Curiosity brings you here. This is NPR.
This is WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With food and gas prices continuing to climb, more and more Wisconsin residents are finding their food budgets don't stretch as much as they used to.
Last month, Jackie Anderson, the head of Feeding Wisconsin, told Wisconsin Today that the number of people using food pantries in the state has jumped 30 to 40% since last year.
rent is going up, groceries are expensive. We do know that there are more families who are coming, more children who are coming. So, you know, we definitely can see people who are coming for the first time.
A new program in Wisconsin aims to bring food directly from small and medium-sized farms to help meet those needs. The food advocacy group Hunger Task Force started the Connecting Farms to Families program earlier this year.
Matt King is the chief executive officer of Hunger Task Force, and Michael Gutchenritter is a producer working with the program as the owner of Three Brothers Farm and Prairie Gold Organics in Oconomowoc. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
And Matt, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Matt, let's start with you. Give us the basics. How does this Connecting Farms to Families program work?
Hunger Task Force is the recipient of a $2.5 million grant through the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, DATCAP. And that's through a newly established Food Security and Wisconsin Products Grant Program. The funds are being used to support Hunger Task Force and a program called Connecting Farms to Families. This program connects local nonprofit food assistance programs with local producers, connecting families in need with nutritious food and supporting our local agricultural economy at the same time.
Now, for people who receive this food, where might they see it appearing? What are some of the venues that the food will go to families?
Yeah, in the first allocation, over 150 emergency food organizations in currently 58 counties across the state are receiving this healthy produce, dairy, and proteins from Wisconsin growers and producers. So these are local food assistance organizations, primarily community volunteer-led organizations that are on small budgets. And so this program is really helping them to gain access to this high quality, nutritious, and locally sourced food.
And Michael, before we get into how you're working with this this organization, can you first introduce us to your farm?
Yeah, I own with my family Three Brothers Farm, and we also own Prairie Gold Organics. And Prairie Gold is buying eggs from my farm and two other farms, Stock Family Farm and Prairie Folk Farm. Together, we're processing the eggs and then distributing them mainly to grocery stores and restaurants. And now we're delivering 750 dozen a week to Hunger Task Force.
How did you get connected with Hunger Task Force and the Connecting Farms to Families program?
Yeah, we've been working with Hunger Task Force for a long time in various capacities. This is definitely the largest capacity and most reliable that we've partnered on. Basically, I have been growing our business, and when we took on another farm to buy eggs from, I was looking for new accounts, and I reached out to Kyle at Hunger Task Force, because we had already been providing them with eggs for their tribal elder box program. And he said that he had just received a grant and was able to buy from us right away. So I had been looking for accounts, and Hunger Task Force stepped up.
Matt, we heard a little bit about Michael's farm there. What kind of farms are you looking for? What are your target scales of farm and things like that?
Well, through this program, we're using 100% of the funds to support hunger relief programs across the state. But we're really focused on small and mid-sized Wisconsin farms. So these are all Wisconsin-owned small to mid-sized businesses. The types of producers include vegetable growers, dairy farmers, cheese makers, and ranchers. So really across the board, a variety of Wisconsin products.
And Matt, a key here, this isn't, you're not out just soliciting donations from these farmers. They are getting paid for their produce. Why is that important as part of the sustainability of this food relief program?
Well, it's really a win-win, because local food assistance organizations are getting access to these high quality locally sourced foods that they wouldn't otherwise. But it's also stimulating and sustaining our local agricultural economy. And in particular, in rural spaces around the state. And it's also gotten the community really excited about that. In Wisconsin, we have a deep agricultural history, and a lot of people really relate to that. So these grant funds have also gotten the donor and philanthropic community really interested. And so we've been able to leverage over $2 million in private funds alongside this grant program to amplify and expand this initiative, which gives these producers a reliable account. It allows them to expand markets. And what it has been doing is creating connections between these local organizations and then producers in their area.
Michael, you've mentioned it was nice to have this account. How does this fit into your business? This is the only place your eggs are going. How big a part of the business of providing eggs is this Hunger Task Force providing you?
We provide eggs to about 50 different grocery stores across Southeast Wisconsin. And Hunger Task Force takes about 25% of our eggs right now. So it definitely serves as a large account for us. So in terms of business, it helps us grow sustainably and significantly.
And Michael, for you as a producer, is it meaningful to you that, hey, yes, of course, you're selling to grocery stores and other businesses, but knowing that at least part of your production is going to help families in need, what does that mean for you personally?
Yeah, right. Like I said, it in terms of business, it helps us grow, but it also allows us to live out our true values, which is equally important to our family and all of our employees. We've produced some of the highest quality protein in Wisconsin, and we've always believed that everyone should have access to it. This program allows us to make that happen while generating the income that our business needs to thrive.
Matt, I think sometimes people might think when they're shopping of organic eggs or higher quality produce or fresh produce in general as almost a luxury if they have a tight grocery budget. Why is it important to you to have, you know, not just food, but good quality food as part of this program?
Well, I think Michael's talking about our values and our shared values. And one of those is dignity. And we believe that when people fall on hard times, as neighbors and as a community, protecting the dignity of our neighbors is important. And having access to healthy, high quality foods is a key part of that.
We're talking about the Connecting Farms to Families program created by Hunger Task Force. It's supplying food grown in Wisconsin to food programs around the state. Matt King is with us, Chief Executive Officer of Hunger Task Force, and Michael Gutchenritter, owner of Prairie Gold Organics and Economowoc, which is participating in the program. Matt, are you still looking to recruit more farmers like Michael to join in this program?
Yeah, this is a multi-year initiative, and we're in the early phases of it right now. So far, in addition to the over 150 emergency food organizations that have been receiving products, there have been more than 250 different producers that have participated. And we are looking to sustain and continue the program. This is really becoming a core part of our work. And the more that we can direct food purchasing dollars into our local economy, we believe that that strengthens not only the emergency food system, but the food system as a whole.
Michael, if a producer came to you and said, hey, yeah, Hunger Task Force has been asking me to get on board with this, what would you say to them about participating?
Well, I would say that it's been basically life-changing for our business. And as long as they can reliably produce whatever they're producing, I'd say it's going to be a really good fit. You know, a lot of the smaller producers focus on quality over quantity. So being able to kind of push the farm a little bit to produce a lot of a quality product and know that there's a market waiting for them is huge for small farms, because you know it's a as we all know, getting into agriculture is very hard and it's very expensive. So knowing that there's a market there that's supporting the community can be huge for the values of the business and for the economics of the business.
Matt, as we've mentioned, you've got this grant, $2.5 million from the state of Wisconsin for this program. How long does that state funding last, at least under present plans?
This is the first year of a two-year program inside of the Wisconsin state budget. So in 2027, we will need to continue advocating for the continuance of this program and hopefully the expansion of the program. Regardless of the state funding, we will continue this program through private dollars. As I mentioned, we've been able to leverage over $2 million of privately raised funds in addition to the state grant. But being able to continue the program at this level and to ideally grow it in scope will depend distinctly on whether or not this continues to be a state-funded program.
And Michael, I understand you've worked to help create a foundation to help continue this program after the lifespan of that grant. What are you working on?
I'm pretty experienced with grants, and I know that there are always going to be funding gaps. And so I started the foundation to help fill those gaps, minimally for eggs, and also for produce and meat from other small farms in Southeast Wisconsin. So the idea is that we will essentially do our best to fill the gap when the funding has small gaps. We're working on it, and we're trying to get an executive director in place to take more leadership for the program while I work on Prairie Gold and Three Brothers Farm. We're basically trying to get our customers to support the program in order to keep the eggs flowing into Hunger Task Force.
Michael, staying with you, one of the big trends in agriculture in Wisconsin and more so even around the country is consolidation, bigger farms, government officials saying things like, you know, get big or get out over the years. Do you see programs like this one as one piece of the puzzle to help keep small and medium-sized producers prospering in Wisconsin?
I'd say it's not a small piece of the puzzle. I'd say it's a huge piece of the puzzle. I mean, for us, it's literally 25% of our sales going into the hunger relief efforts. So it's massive. And if this can gain even more momentum, we would be more than happy to grow with it. And I know that other farms are looking for ways to get their food into the hunger relief efforts also. So if Hunger Task Force is able to find more ways to create the money to make this happen, I think a lot of farms are going to be able to thrive and stay small to medium without, you know, selling out their values.
And Matt, as part of the wider picture when it comes to hunger relief, we know, of course, inflation has hit food prices, which makes people need food assistance more and raises the prices for people providing food assistance. How big a factor can a program like this going directly producers play in helping address those needs?
Yeah, collectively around the state, the network that's participating in this program is serving over 180,000 households each month. And the number one, you know, driver of that need is the increased costs of groceries, utilities, rent, putting a lot of pressure on working families. And we're seeing a lot of young working families with children seeking help for the first time. And so this program has been critical, particularly for rural communities where their food pantry may have a small budget for food purchasing. And so they've been able to access foods through this program that they wouldn't have otherwise.
Matt, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Michael, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. I appreciate the opportunity.
Matt King is the chief executive officer of Hunger Task Force, and Michael Gutchenritter is the owner of Three Brothers Farm and Prairie Gold Organics in Oconomowoc.
With the Wisconsin State Fair underway, we want to find out what is the craziest food you've tried at a fair.
Wisconsin Today producer Trevor Hook, our show's intrepid foodie, gave us a dispatch from the State Fair.
Trevor says the birria flamenbombs from Fiesta Grill and Cantina weren't as messy as I feared. The birria consomme and the chipotle aioli balanced out what could have been a heavy dish.
Trevor also gives a thumbs up to the porky puff. He calls the golden flaky pastry an interesting sweet and savory experiment that pays off well.
Thanks, Trevor. Share about the fair food you've tried, like bug apple on a stick. How about bring on the crickets, worms, and ants?
Yum or not, email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org with your state fair delicacies. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.